Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to continue our dialogue around how to take your money away from Wall Street and put it to work on Main Street. It is our mission to surface and promote the sorts of investments that make our world a better place. And fortunately, there are more and more examples to choose from thanks to dedicated and hardworking people everywhere. And I was really intrigued by something that came up in a recent interview with Michael Schumann on local investment opportunities when he said this.
What I attribute Burlington's success to is that for the last 25 years, their economic development team, led in part by a fellow named Bruce Seifer, focused not on the attraction of global companies, but focused instead on the nurturing of local business and local entrepreneurship. And they did it in 100 different ways. They've done it through, you know, very careful downtown development of Burlington. They've done it through entrepreneurship programs and lending programs targeted to women, immigrants, minority groups. They've done it through interesting types of smart growth. They've done it through helping to organize small local business alliances as something different from the typical chamber of commerce, which usually gives bigger companies a louder voice. And I just feel like, you know, that is a testament, that is a design of economic development that more and more communities should be paying attention to.
Now, that's worth following up on. So today we are talking with Bruce Seifer to find out more about exactly how Burlington went about creating a vibrant and attractive local economy by systematically diversifying its businesses and thinking about where they wanted to go and how they were going to get there. Bruce Seifer is a consultant with extensive experience in economic development. Under former mayors Bernie Sanders and Peter Clavel, he led Burlington, Vermont's community and economic development efforts for 28 years by developing a nationally recognized model for locally focused, community-oriented urban revitalization. He's also co-author of the book, Sustainable Communities, Creating a Durable Local Economy. Welcome, Bruce. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to begin by jumping straight to the end of the story. How's Burlington doing today?
Yeah, I recently looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics unemployment rate, which is something I used to track when I worked for the city for 28 years. And they have 372 municipal regions where they track their unemployment rate, which is one factor of many that you look at when you're looking at an economy. And Burlington has the fourth lowest unemployment rate in the United States, sort of currently, out of 372 municipal regions. And we actually were usually in the top 2 percentile of the unemployment rates for many years, but it's gotten better. Another piece of information that we tracked during the height of the Great Recession that we, as a nation, felt, and we had the lowest foreclosure rate of any city in the United States, which meant that people's net income, I mean not their net income, but their net worth didn't shrink like many cities around the United States where people lost their house value. So those are two pieces of information. The other one we look at is our vacancy rates for commercial buildings in town and you know, look at whether or not there's vacant buildings. And basically, there's virtually no vacant commercial buildings, and the vacancy rate is extremely low. So, you know, companies want to be in Burlington, and they want to grow in Burlington, but that wasn't always the case. You know, when I started 30 years ago, it was a much different picture.
Well, let's talk about that picture. I mean, by the numbers, we got very low unemployment, obviously a much more resilient response to the overall housing crisis that happened with the lowest mortgage failure rates. And obviously your buildings are full. And so that wasn't always the case, I guess. So let's rewind to the beginning. Many towns and cities I know of roughly the size of Burlington have not really fared all that well in recent decades. So 30 years ago when you started, what sort of shape was Burlington in?
When I started working for the city of Burlington under the administration of former mayor Bernie Sanders, and then Mayor Peter Clavelle. My focus during those years was to assist the newly created Community and Economic Development Office in its essence, in its efforts to recharge the economy and improve the lives of working people. Burlington, Vermont, was saddled with, at that time, 16 vacant storefronts, and more than a dozen businesses had moved out of Burlington in the midst of a national economy that we had high unemployment rate. And kind of on top of all that, Bernie Sanders was mayor, and the Sanderistas that we were called at the time were labeled as anti-business. And due to the socialist label that Bernie wore proudly as a voice for the elderly and poor and working people of the city. So we worked very hard to turn things around and to try to make things a little bit better day by day. And one of the things that we did was to develop a long-term economic development plan that usually that we followed for 30 years with some updates. And that was something that where we were able to build building blocks over time over our economy and found out what we needed, what we were missing, and then kind of helped to try to build that over time. And we did a whole suite of programs that were identified in our plan. And over time, the economy gradually got better and the drumbeat of opposition slowly subsided.
Well, now it's interesting to me how these things turn out differently, like the tale of two cities, right? Locally, we have a tale of two cities here. We've got one small village, town, whatever you want to call it, Shelburne Falls, which is it's vibrant and it's really hopping. And it's got this critical mass of greatness going on there. It's got artists and it's got businesses and, you know, it's got that vibe. And another town even closer to me called Turner's Falls has all the bones that it needs, right? It's got these beautiful, wide, old mill town streets and wonderful lamp poles and good buildings. But it's very much at the opposite end of this story. And so I'm interested in how you know, one area can thrive and another area with seemingly the same opportunities cannot. What were some of those pieces that you found were essential?
Well, I guess some of the lessons learned that we had is that vision is important, but you have to create the capacity to implement the vision. And we felt that development created with the principles, with a priority for sustainable development, was important. And one of the things that we learned, that was one of the big lessons we learned in the about 1993, was to serve the people in your community first by building facilities for yourselves, and then other people will come. And the other thing that we did, which is not rocket science, but it's pretty much behind everything we did, is pretty simple, is we asked people in need what they needed, and then we try to figure out how to meet their needs. And we were more like a gardener for small businesses. You know, we'd focus on small businesses and try to find ways to help them grow to become major employers and economic players. And so we did things, you know, if they needed financing, we ended up starting a small business loan fund. If they needed training around understanding finance, we set up training programs for them. Sometimes they said they'd like to work with other like type of businesses and learn from each other. So we would set up trade associations working in concert with them. And, you know, we would tend them over the years. We provided ongoing technical business advice to those business people. So they, if they had an issue on, you know, getting a permit or they had problems with, you know, sewer overflow, whatever it may be, we're always there trying to solve their problems. And as a result of all of that, we ended up helping a lot of companies, a lot of small companies, become bigger companies. And part of what you're talking about is also we had political leaders that were able to articulate the shared values that people, and by doing that, people felt empowered to make things happen and became unstoppable. So there was a whole range of things that we were doing, but it was really listening to the public and responding to their needs, you know, and also identifying weaknesses within our community, and we did that through a long-term economic development plan that I mentioned before. I'll give you one example. We had an industrial area that was bombed out with lots of vacant buildings, and companies had moved out. It was kind of the deindustrialization, and they're going through a lot of disinvestment. People were no longer investing in those buildings, and so our strategy was, again, not rocket science. We looked for the most ugly vacant building that people saw on the most traveled street, and we worked with the developer to fix that up into an incubator space. Because part of our plan was to develop small companies. They needed space for those businesses to start or expand. And so we worked with the developer and got a federal grant, which we lent to the developer and fixed it up. And they became, people started believing that the economy is turning around. So then we went after the next building that was ugly and vacant, and the next. And, the political folks who wanted to get in office ran a full-page ad blaming Bernie Sanders, the mayor, for all these vacant buildings, even though he had recently just been elected. So we used that full-page ad as a place to graft all these buildings. I mean, by the time years went by, we fixed them all up. We didn't do it ourselves. We worked, with the developers or property owners or businesses to fix it up and identify resources. And where resources didn't exist, we worked with our government partners to create new funding mechanisms. And we made sure that we understood what we were doing, and it was complex financial transactions, and we learned how to do, financial analysis. We took a lot of workshops and seminars, and before that we hired experts to help us figure that stuff out. But it's complicated. So for a community that has a lot of buildings, it's a matter of talking to those people in the community to say, how can we help you to fix it up? And creating a plan and helping people actually plan and get motivated.
How can we help you? If that's socialism, sign me up. Because I got to tell you, my experience with in my state doing business, oftentimes I feel like the people on the other end of the phone ought to answer it by saying, Department of Business Prevention, how may I stop you? It's not often that I've run into people who are on the what I'll call the regulatory town side who are there saying, how can we help? We're in this together. Let's figure this out. It feels adversarial. You're describing something that doesn't sound very adversarial to me.
No, it wasn't. It was our office was created during the height of in 1983. It was created. There was a city council. Passed a resolution trying to figure out what do we do in order to recharge our economy. And so the head of the industrial development group, a Republican, co-chaired by the Mayor Sanders' assistant and his treasurer, and the two of them came up with a strategy. And the strategy was, we have a planning and development office, and we wanted to bifurcate that office and create two departments. The planning, whose job it is to kind of do what you just talked about, put your foot on the brakes, go through the regulations and make sure everything's built according to plan. And then we wanted to have a development office whose job was to put their foot on the gas and to build and strengthen the economy. And so that happened, and the mayor hired the director. And one of the first things that we did was we worked with the University of Vermont and did a statistically significant survey to figure out what people in the community wanted. Again, getting back to what you want. And we had a series of questions, but the one important question was, do you want the city to develop projects? Do you want the city to encourage development? Or you want the city to have their hands off? And over 70% of the people said, we want the city to guide development. And so we asked people, and we got a statistically significant study, to say, guide and support development. And so that helped us identify kind of what we should be doing. And then we brought in a group called the Industrial Cooperative Association at a Somerville, Mass., and they helped us develop our strategic economic plan in 1983, 1984, which we then followed for 30 years. And the plan at that time was, we wanted to promote and support local ownership of businesses, small businesses, and work on things like seal the leaky bucket. If you look at the economy and where the money's leaving your economy, and develop strategies to figure out how to spend less money on energy that's going to be exported and use your own local energy and food systems. How do we grow our own food and create kind of a food system that would keep our capital locally and create jobs? You know, we had a goal of 100 jobs in the food sector and grow 10% of our local food. And we had a strategy, the overarching strategy was called the Burlington Local Ownership Development Program, was to promote locally owned businesses and with a whole suite of programs, and our goal was to promote employee-owned companies. And we felt that employee-owned ownership in the early 80s was something that people saw as they didn't understand it, and so we decided to promote local ownership with a preference of employee ownership, and that was our goal. And part under those, there was a set of strategies to provide a series of programs and funding mechanisms and approaches, and we built off of that. And I think that in the long run, we were ahead of our time in employee ownership, where it was probably another 10 years before the Vermont Employee Ownership Center got developed, and they've subsequently helped 14 companies to transition from traditional ownership to employee ownership, securing our employees in our community instead of maybe having those companies sell out and move them out of town. But we also helped small little companies become much bigger companies and, again, provided them a whole range of services. And the whole local ownership, localism movement is very big in the last 3 or 4 years, but that's something we worked on, you know, for 25, 30 years, and it seemed to work, and, you know, based on the data that I mentioned at the beginning of the interview. And over time, the anti-business fervor that was fostered through the political conversation, people realized that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Our main street, which is called Church Street, is thriving. You know, and people fixed up every building, and companies chose to locate here, and they liked the quality of life. It wasn't just about business. We looked at finding ways to help make it so the cultural economy was successful in our community, and the mayor started an arts council, and which has subsequently helped create over 200 events every year, which adds to the, you know, quality of life. And it was kind of an approach that looked at a half a dozen aspects of our economy. And our book, Sustainable Communities, Creating a Durable Local Economy, basically describes the framework of what we did and, more importantly, how we did it.
So let me ask the obvious question here. Where is Burlington on the subject of the big box stores?
Sprawl? Oh, that's a good question. The city of Burlington had a very viable downtown, but there was a company called Pyramid Mall that was out of Syracuse, wanted to develop a big mall in our neighboring town, which is 7 miles away. And the city decided that they looked at the government laws, which is called, in Vermont, it's called Act 250, which is a region-wide planning law. And we didn't believe that it was consistent with the plan that was duly adopted by the region and also with regards to the state statutes. And so we went to court to stop their project. 17 years we were in court.
Wow.
Fighting the development of the big boxes and the sprawl. And we ended up did a lot of research, and one of the research, we worked with Senator Leahy to look at predatory practices of the companies to see how they had unfair competition. And so we looked at that as one store. We looked at how we invested in our public infrastructure as a community with public dollars, and we noticed that we spent $100 million on existing infrastructure, and if the sprawl would go on, the communities would have to pay for that, and there'd be no money for that. So we did research on that. We looked at wages that were paid and how much you know, in public subsidies would have to be to go towards subsidizing some of these firms because they didn't pay well enough, and a lot of those people are, you know, getting transfer payments. And so, you know, we looked at the whole infrastructure for the roads and how much would be needed in order to support it, and identified it was going to cost a lot of money. There was no money for it. So we did a lot of research on that, and we felt that we needed to go to court and fight for what the law said. And eventually, the mall that got developed looked more like a town center, and we agreed that they wouldn't build any, they agreed that they wouldn't build anything more than 50,000 square feet, and we took away our lawsuit with that agreement. And so that gave us time to invest in our downtown, and we invested millions of dollars to get a department store in our downtown, which at the time was Filene's, and we did a lot more work. And so our made sure that we had our we did an offensive approach, which is build our downtown, and the defense was go to court. And it, I think that a lot of communities across the country contacted us. This fellow named Al Norman contacted us about, you know, fighting, you know, sprawl and how do you do it. And so we worked with other communities to look at what the best practices were, and we shared what we learned. And in the book, Sustainable Communities, Creating a Durable Local Economy, we talk about all this, about the, some of the studies. We did some seminal research that looked at some of the impacts, the true impacts, and which has been used by other communities.
Now, I want to talk more about this leaky bucket. I, you know, big box stores come up as an obvious source of a hole in your bucket, at least in, for people who are against the concept. People who are for the big boxes just say, I'm already poor. I want best prices. You know, you can see there's a lot of territory between those views. But you mentioned energy. That's the most obvious big hole, and one that's growing bigger as oil becomes more expensive. How do you go about plugging that one?
Well, we were lucky in one sense in that the city owned our electric utility. Mm-hmm. And the way that the city government is structured is that the mayor and the city council, to, with some agencies, appoint a commission that oversees the department. In this case, in that department, it was the city council that appoints people that oversee the public policy at the electric department. When Bernie Sanders was mayor, he looked at the rate structure and realized that corporations were paying less than their fair share and homeowners and residents were paying more, so he worked to restructure the pricing. That was one thing that was done early on. And when he became mayor, we had a vote, and we looked at developing our own power supply, and so we created at that time a 50-megawatt wood chip power plant, which at the time was the largest wood chip power electric power plant in the world. And we participated in a dam in a neighboring river that bordered Burlington, and the citizens voted to support that. We also voted to support a trashed energy plant, which we trashed once an analysis was done by the city's treasurer to realize that was a bad investment. And then fast forward to 1993 or so, 1992, the city's electric department was considering buying electric power from a dam in Hydro-Quebec. And a resident called me up and said we should fight that. The Cree and Inuit are going to be flooded out. And we learned all about what the impacts were. And we studied what those impacts were. We talked with Mayor Clavel at the time. And we just figured out before we buy Hydro-Quebec, we should get a second opinion about what our policy should be on power demand. And so I created what I call a shadow commission. It's the commission oversees the electric department, but I got a group of citizens who knew energy policy as well as regular citizens. And we got the city council's community development committee to pony up some money for a second opinion on our power demand, because part of the electric department's requirements are to do power planning. They had brought a group in from Wharton through Pennsylvania that said power demand grows 2% a year. I was in charge of economic development. I went to a public hearing that nobody was at, and I raised my hand at the public time. And I said, how do you know it's going to grow 2% a year? And they said, well, that's, you know, standard metrics in the electric world. That's how it grows. You know, and that conversation still goes on 25 years later to today. And I said, well, no one talked to me. I'm in charge of economic development, and we don't have that kind of growth. And so at that point, I realized that they were not looking at us as a community, but us as an ecosystem compared to other ecosystems. And so the study that we did looked at what else we could do besides buy power. And the study said if we invested $25 million in efficiency work, it would be cheaper than buying Hydro-Quebec and we wouldn't need the power. And so we, as a community, decided on bringing a bond vote to the community for $11.2 million. And the city residents raised their hand and said, we want a bond for that kind of money. And the electric department was then tasked to invest in conservation and efficiency in businesses. And that was over 20 years ago. And now the city of Burlington is using less electricity than we were back then, even with all the huge amount of growth that we've had, because we invested in conservation and efficiency. And it turns out that now it's half as expensive to invest in efficiency and conservation and than it is to buy new power. The other expense that you don't need, which is a huge expense, is the transmission lines. And so if you don't have more power demand, you don't have to build all these transmission lines, which are, you know, multi-$100 million transmission systems. So we didn't need that. And we put local contractors to work. And we had everybody's bills were lower as a result of that. Our rates might have gone up, but their bills were lower. And it turns out, fast forward 20 years ago to today, is that the homeowners and the businesses are paying $10 million a year less than if we wouldn't have invested in conservation and efficiency. So we sealed that bucket. Not only did we seal the bucket, but we sealed the leaks in people's homes and businesses.
Uh-huh.
And so their bills are lower on average than other businesses and homeowners in Vermont and throughout the Northeast. So that's an energy story that could be replicated around the country, if not the world, have bonding to the community, and that money goes into efficiency programs, and also providing technical advice to businesses on how to do things efficiently. It's almost counterintuitive, where the electric utility is saying, we want you to use less electricity. You know, because if you look at the pricing of electric power, they look at the peak power demand during the hottest day, and with global warming, climate change, more of those extreme weather patterns are happening. So if you can shave off and develop programs to shave off the peak power demand, the pricing that's associated with that causes power costs to be really astronomical. So there's another incentive to invest in efficiency or other measures in order to reduce the demand during peak power. Our peak power demand in Vermont, where it's been very cold all winter here, is in the summer, air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And with it, you know, climate change, we're gonna, you know, it's getting hotter and hotter, we're going to have more air conditioning. So it's actually more cost effective to invest in efficiency, and it actually saves people money, and it puts people to work, the engineers, the contractors, the people who supply the engineers and the contractors materials. And I myself weatherized my house over 20 years ago, and 20 years later I did it again, and my bills are so much less, and I'm so much more comfortable. You don't have to wear a sweater in the middle of winter. You know, it's like your house isn't drafty, and it's actually, there's health benefits that go with that. You know, people have dry skin, people have other issues with regards to drafts and stuff. You're elderly, you're not comfortable. So there's other reasons and other ways to seal the leaky bucket. And the other very important issue in Burlington is when we did the initial study to determine, do we want to buy Hydro-Quebec, or what kind of power do we want to buy? Do we want to buy nuclear power? Do we want to buy coal? Do we want to buy wind? Do we want to buy dams, Do we want to do solar? And we came up with a system to determine what the externality costs were for each of those other electric generating systems. And we used that to factor in what the cost of power is going to be. So, you know, nuclear waste, what do you do with that? So there's a cost to go with the nuclear waste now and into the future. You need to factor all those things in. So we factored all those externality costs when we're determining what the true cost over the life cycle of the power generation system you're going to get into. And so with that, we determine what we want to invest in with a true cost. And so we looked at all of that, and we determined we wanted to have more renewable power back over 20 years ago and less reliant on nuclear power and coal, because coal is causing acid rain, which is killing the lakes, which is raining down on our community. And now Burlington, on town meeting day in March of this year, voted to buy some additional dams than when we had voted on 30 years ago. And we just are buying that dam. And with that, we are now going to be 100% renewable electric energy for the city of Burlington.
Wow. I love this story. I love this story. And you know, you mentioned the two magic words in all of this, where people regularly are very concerned about climate change. And oftentimes sort of the conversation ends with that angst. And, you know, what do you do about it? Well, what do you do about it is what Burlington has done, which is if we can put money into efficiency and we have, let me tally this up, a higher quality of life, maybe there's some health benefits. We've put local people to work in contracting and putting those efficiency measures in place. We've saved money and we are putting less carbon into the atmosphere. Bruce, why aren't more communities doing this?
Well, you need political leadership and political will to get behind some of these initiatives. You need an engaged citizenry with a way for them to participate in the process. And somebody has to make a decision that they're going to invest money in a certain kind of way. And it usually comes down to politics and political will. And I think that that is really important. And in our book, Sustainable Communities Creating a Durable Local Economy, that's something I learned on the job. Mm-hmm. On the job training was the role that politics plays in developing a sane, sound economic development strategy. You know, people need to run for office. People need to support people for running to office. People need to be involved with developing the policy for people who are running for office. People need to be willing to serve and work on the inside to carry out the policy, which I borrowed in as a former person used to go to demonstrations against different things. I decided to put my time where my belief system was. You need people to volunteer to do that kind of work. And some of these things are a political decision down the road. Do we do this or we do that? And you need the right people in office that have a belief system that they're going to actually then carry out what they're going to say. We luckily had leaders in our community at different levels, starting with Mayor Bernie Sanders, who's now the senator for Vermont. And we had other people like Peter Clavel, who became mayor after Bernie, and he turned out to be the longest-serving mayor for 15 years. And he understood that through a long-term planning process that we developed, that we set up a set of principles that we followed. And so when you're elected in office, if the principles are derived from the community, then it's easier to govern that, you know, and the principles come from the community, that you then fall back on these principles. So in Burlington, for example, you know, one of the principles was to equalize the benefits and burdens of growth. And the other one, based on our conversation currently, is protect and preserve the environment. The other one is ensure full participation of everyone in the community, especially and importantly, populations normally excluded than the political and economic mainstream. And then, of course, if you want to do a lot of things, is to leverage and recycle scarce resources. And then, of course, for us, we thought it was important to nurture a robust nonprofit and now a fourth sector, which is working in concert with local government to deliver the essential goods and services. And importantly, but not last, but least, is to encourage economic self-sufficiency through local ownership and the maximum use of local resources to get back to sealing the, the leaky bucket. So in order to do these things, it requires the political will, political courage, the political support, and sometimes, you know, it's hard with being a politician, which I'm not, to do things and say things if you don't have people supporting you. So one of the things that we did was I helped create an organization called Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Two different groups of business people came to me and said, we want to set up a business group. One of them was, they called themselves Socialists for Capitalism. And that was people like Ben Cohen and Terry Eric from Hemings Motor News and Harry Atkinson, who was a local energy person, and Todd Lockwood. And then there was another group of business people that had a social conscience, and we got them together, and we worked with them to create a trade association. And my role was to say, not only help them create the organization, but they had a national group, a New England group called New England Businesses for Social Responsibility, who we were working with, and they wanted them to work on sharing information and educating each other. And I said, you need politics, political will. You need to work on political influence. And so we created Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. One of the three things they did was advocacy on the political world. And they worked on many different projects over time in Vermont, raised the minimum wage, family leave before there was national family leave, creating something called the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, which is a skunk works statewide fund funded by the state to support innovative economic development, which could be replicated in other states across the country. And the state has been contributing over $200,000 a year for that fund. And so that will, political will, by bringing business people together to learn about politics, some of those people ran for office. Turns out the public policy person who worked for them ran for governor. And some of these people got very involved. And it's not a fly-by-night organization. Now it's one of the biggest business organizations in Vermont, with well over 1,200 members, which is big in Vermont standards. And they advocate for that. And they're working actually on national policy, which is something new, through a national business organization. So it's important for communities to understand the role of politics. It's not a dirty thing. And it's important to help forge policies and programs. It could be as simple as, in a local community, as what's the zoning? How do you change zoning to make it meet the needs of the local community? As simple as creating a streamlined permit process that is predictable, and creating systems in place for the government to function effectively. So you take care of streets and sidewalks, and you look at alternatives to the property tax to fund government, and you think about all those things. In order to do that, those are political decisions that somebody has to work on. And that is something that in Burlington, we were lucky that a lot of people were energized by people like Bernie Sanders, and they got involved with local elected politics and statewide politics. And that's how, when decisions are being made, we want X or Y, they then look back to what the community said, what are our principles, and they have to stick by those things. And those hopefully eclipse election cycles. When you have principles and plans and policies and programs and strategies that have been developed through the bottom up based on those principles, then hopefully helps deal with the election cycles, where people then run for office because they know what the community wants, and they want to continue to follow through on some of the policies and strategies that have been identified, supported by those principles.
Well, let's say you move to a community different from Burlington, where you assess that, you know, you wanted the same outcomes as were achieved in Burlington, but maybe the political system wasn't oriented that way at this point in time. How would you, this is a question really for somebody who's listening going, yeah, I want that in my town, but how do I get that? Where would you start?
I think it's good for people to go to city council meetings, or we have a cable access. You can watch them at the comfort of your home. I would go to hearings of the Planning Commission or the Development Review Commission. I would go to those offices and get to meet people, you know, and meet with them, set up an appointment. I would actually read the underlying government documents that, you know, statutes, and become familiar with those. Becoming active in a neighborhood association. If there isn't a neighborhood association, create a neighborhood association and invite the politicians to a neighborhood meeting. Have, you know, coffees at your house and invite the local elected officials to your house and talk about things that are near and dear to your heart. And then get involved and you find people that think like you and start helping them. You know, write a letter, support your local paper, call up the radio station or the internet station that's following them and, you know, ask about certain things. Go to the hearings and express your opinion. Like, I went to the electric department public hearing on energy demand and followed through. Maybe create a group that's going to follow a certain issue and stick with it. Look for advisors that might be able to help you in the community. Talk to the local newspaper. Meet with reporters and talk about your issues of the day that you think are important and get newspaper coverage. I found one of the best things to do is get news coverage about issues that you think are important. If your road is potholed, talk with the guy who's in charge of public works. Talk to your city council. Talk to the mayor. If that doesn't work, talk to the newspapers. You know, invite the cameras, the TV cameras, to go down there and find someone in a wheelchair who's trying to get through there and film them. You know, and sometimes you need to embarrass people if they're not going to do anything. But preferably, the best thing is to talk with people face-to-face and become educated about what the rules and regulations are and bring people together to talk about those issues. We have something called the Front Porch Forum in Vermont, which started in my neighborhood. In fact, there was a fellow who wanted to start it, and he came to me for business advice. I helped him with it, and now he's in all the 200-some-odd towns in Vermont. And that is an electronic bulletin board, basically, where people can talk about issues of import to them. And so a lot of stuff get posted on the, you know, do we want this? We don't want that. What's the problems with this? And all the elected officials see all that stuff. And when I worked in government for all those years, people would, you know, race to try to solve those problems because you might not just know. And so the best thing is to create forums and opportunities to people to have a dialogue, because usually people in government generally want to do the right thing. You know, and they generally have pride in their community and they care about their community. They might have different ways to go about doing it, but make yourself be heard. And I think that to me is what you do. Make yourself heard.
Well, fantastic. Bruce, I really want to thank you for your time today. We've been talking with Bruce Seifer, author, co-author of Sustainable Communities, Creating a Durable Local Economy. And I note here that you're actually, you have three events that you're doing in Massachusetts, my home state, in April. So it turns out people could invite you to their community as well. Is that true?
Yes. Actually, I just talked to the National Community Development Association. They had a New England meeting 2 days ago in Worcester, Mass. All the people in charge of community development for all the towns in the Northeast. And then the Jamaica Plains, which is outside of Boston, they're going to have a forum I'm going to speak at. And at Harvard, I'm organizing and moderating and speaking at a forum where I'm bringing people from around the country to Harvard called the Sustainable Communities Forum to talk about the lessons. It's kind of putting our book to life, is bringing the people, the actors in the book, and basically having them explain their story. And we're going to have a professor from Harvard. One of the students at Harvard was actually one of my interns for 3 years. And so we're having that forum. And I'm going to be speaking at Green Mountain College and in Bali, the national organization, in June, leading a public policy discussion, two of discussions in June. So I've been lecturing on a regular basis. And I think the last thing I'd like to say, if I might, is is that success builds on action, both successful and failures. And St. Francis de Assisi said that first do what's necessary, then do what's possible, and before you know it, you're doing the impossible.
Success builds on action. I love that. And not all successes come from successful actions. Lots of failures in there. And of course, in the world I see coming, we're going to have to try lots of brand new things. So I love hearing how you've navigated the space so far and that it's possible to make our world a better place and to come up with more durable, resilient communities. That's really what's on the top of the minds of most people listening to this right now. So, Bruce, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for the work you've done and for sharing it with everyone.
I'm happy to share this with other communities, and that's why I work with two other folks to write a book on, you know, how we went about doing this. There's a lot of lessons learned, so building an inner-city supermarket doesn't need to take 17 years. there's a case study in there to do it quick, in 2 or 3 years. If you want your own food system, you know, what is the way to do it? You know, we spent many 20-plus years, and there's a case study on that. You know, if you want to work with refugees and immigrants to start businesses, there's a good case study on how to do that successfully. And so the book, Sustainable Communities, is designed to help communities learn from what we did, but do it in a much quicker way than we did.
Excellent. Well, we'll have a link straight to that book appearing right under this podcast. So we'll provide a link there. And how else can people follow your work?
We have a website called Durable Communities. And so people can keep track of where we're speaking and some tips that we're going to have a blog that we're going to activate shortly, and that will have tips on how to build a durable economy. And I think that's probably the best way, and my email address is on there. And I think that's probably the best approach. And then the other way, actually, is to go to some of these events that I'm organizing. I'm happy to speak at other communities on how to build a durable, sensible economy. It's not, a lot of this stuff is not rocket science. It really is fairly simple to speak of, and I'm happy to help other communities think that through.
Well, and the chief message I get from that as a closing thought is, somebody once told me that putting your money to work on Wall Street is lazy money, and putting your money to work and actually building real value in your community is hard work. That's hard money, but the rewards are entirely different. And with that, people are hungry to take their lazy money and go put it to good work, and that takes effort. It's not just about the money; it's about the intention and the time you bring to that as well. So, Bruce, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck.
Thank you very much, Chris. All right, have a nice day.
Thank you. Bye.